Valentine, California, March 1st, 1970. Discovered by Franklin F. Wolf. This is a continuation of the discourse of last Sunday. It is often inevitable that when we wish to produce a conceptual representation of a truth, or what purports to be a truth, that we have to use a schema of one kind or another. On the whole, I tend to use a schema that is the natural expression of the realizations upon which this philosophy is based. But at times I use other schemas or correlate with other schemas, such as those of the Theosophical movement, or of Sri Aurobindo, and so forth. By schema, I mean representations of the type of the seven principles of man. There is, for instance, the organization presented in the book known as Esoteric Buddhism. There we have Atma, Buddha, Manas, Kama Manas, Kama Rupa, Prana, Linga Sadhira. It is explained that the gross physical body is not properly a principle, but an effect of these principles. There is also a schema used by the Taraka Yoga, which takes the form of Atman, Karana Upadi, Sukshma Upadi, and Stula Upadi. The Karana Upadi corresponds to Buddhi. The Sukshma Upadi corresponds to higher, lower mind and karma, and the Stula Upadi corresponds to prana, linga sarira, and the Stula sarira, or ghost physical body. This one I have often been able to use as it fits my needs better than the sevenfold classification. It has a disadvantage. Each of these upadis can function, it is said, in independence of the others by combination with the Atman. The Atman can combine with the Buddhi or Karana Upadi and function upon its plane, or it can combine with the Sukshma Upadi and finally with the Stula Upadi, which would be a manifestation on this gross physical plane. There is also the implication, though this is not specifically said, so far as I know, that this functioning could take place at the same time. This is useful for certain purposes. Now another schema that I have found useful is that employed by Sri Aurobindo. He classifies this way, that there is an entity which has three instruments. These three instruments are mind, life, and body ascending, descending order. Then these three instruments have two phases or aspects. The growth phase, that which is functions in the external world, and a subtle phase known as the subtle world, the subtle vital, and the subtle mental. Then in addition to the correlation of mind with matter and with life, and on its own intellectual plane, he classifies certain steps in mind above the head, as he calls it. These are higher mind, illuminated mind, intuition in its own proper sense, over mind, and then in the upper hemisphere, supermind, which is not regarded as truly mental, but from which the mental organs or instruments are derived, and is defined as the activistic principle of Sat-Chit-Ananda. Our study of the different schemas, not only these that I've mentioned, but others that one will find in the literature, reveals that it is not always easy or even possible to build a rigid correspondence between one schema and another. This, however, is not to lead to the implication that one or another is false, but rather is the creation or development that grows out of a certain perspective, and even though they cannot be correlated easily, at least, they may be, from their own perspective, perfectly correct. To illustrate the principle of perspective, we might refer to an event in the history of astronomy that was of premier importance. The shift from what is known as the Ptolemaic system to the Copernican system. In the Ptolemaic system, the base of reference or the system of coordinates that was assumed was fixed with respect to the Earth, and then the relationships or motions of the planet and of the sun were given as they appeared from that base. This is a perfectly valid procedure. The sun goes around the Earth, and so do all of the planets, but not in any simple curve, actually in patterns that are very complex, involving epicycloids, and perhaps even elaborations beyond that. One would ask, is this a true picture? The answer is that if you take the base of reference fixed with respect to the Earth, it is a true picture. And it's one which we still use when we say that the sun rises or the sun sets, which implies that the sun moves. And from that base of reference of the Earth, which is what we assume, that is the truth of the matter. But we can establish a base of reference differently. We can make it fixed with respect to the sun and the plane of the ecliptic. The plane of the ecliptic. now we ask the question, does the sun go around the earth, or does the earth go around the sun? There is no intelligible or valid answer unless we know also the assumed base of reference. If we assume the base as fixed with respect to the earth, then it is false to say that the earth goes around the sun. For it is the other way around. The sun goes around the earth. And vice versa, if we assume the Copernican base of reference, it is false to say that the sun blows around the earth, but true to say that the earth goes around the sun. Now what I wish to suggest by this is that in all of our speech, all of our thinking, we either assume implicitly and unknowingly or explicitly and knowingly some base of reference. And our statements are true or false with respect to that base of reference. In careful thinking, we have to bear this in mind. And that it would explain why, from one base of reference in approaching metaphysical or transcendental truth, it appears one way to one seer and another way to another. If there is not agreement in the schemas that result, that does not imply necessarily that one schema is false and the other true. It does imply that the truth of either is relative to the base of reference or perspective from which it is approached. There is no conceptual statement that is nakedly true in the sense of being absolute. It is true relatively only, relative to some base that is either assumed or explicitly formulated. This is an important point to bear in mind when reading any literature whatever, and specifically in the field of the higher religious philosophy. Well, in what I said last Sunday, I spoke of three forms of cognition. Perceptual cognition or sense perception. Conceptual cognition proper, which is of the type of which mathematics is the supreme expression. And introceptual cognition. The point that I wish to make is that this is a threefold schema. The whole thing as a statement is a conception. A conception that means something, to be sure, and in part means something or points to something beyond conceptuality. So, what we were talking about was really the conceptual view of the perceptual order. Second, the conceptual view of the conceptual order. And third, the conceptual view of the introceptual order. The perceptual order as it is in itself is a matter of sheer experience. and has no words at all. The interceptive order, as it is in itself, has no words either. It is a matter of direct realization. But if we wish to communicate, we have to make use of the conceptual system for this purpose. It's important to bear in mind that the conceptual statement is not the reality. But the conceptual statement is a representation from some base of reference of the reality. It is a representation that points to the reality. But these non-conceptual realities are not to be confused with the conceptual representation of them. This point is in connection with the correlation between the conceptual order and the perceptual order, has been discussed at some length by Carl Zipski in his Science and Sanity. He introduces the term reference as the meaning in the perceptual order of the words that are used. He denies the existence of concepts, a point on which I wholly disagree with, and says there are only words. Thus, for example, if we take the word concept, table, what does it mean? We could try to give a conceptual definition by saying, take a plane surface produced by some reasonably resistant material, such as wood, plastic, metal, or whatnot, held horizontally and supported by three or more vertical posts, which we call legs. And that is what is meant by a table. But if you note, we haven't got, so far, a perceptual existence, which is table. If you wish to step from this conception to the perceptual existence, then you do not use a conceptual definition, but you step over and say, take your hand and touch the table, and you say, that is the meaning of the word or concept table. And what you have done is to step out of one order into the other. When you touch the table and get a sensuous contact with it, you cross a certain barrier. You cannot conceptually think in terms of the sensation that the table produced. Now we have learned how to make this step across from the conceptual order to the perceptual order in our whole domain of applied science, of practical working and so forth. We've learned how to make that leap from the one order to the other. Well, the bearing of this is that there is an implied step from the conceptual order to the interceptual order, and that is where our principal concern lies. Now, we could define the table, for instance, in the conceptual form that I gave. And if we want to ask, go further, we might say, what do you mean by horizontal? So you work out some definition of horizontal. What do you mean by a material substance, such as wood, plastic, or metal? You'd have to define that. What do you mean by three or more posts in a hot vertical, pointing up vertically? And you define that. And you have other terms introduced, you have to define those. And so on, till you come in a series that may have no end, or it may be circulatory. You may ultimately reach the point where you define your term by reference to one of your first terms. In that case, you get into circular definition. You never get out of the conceptual system to an actual table. Now, we don't have a problem of this kind in our relationship between the conceptual and the perceptual orders. We have worked that out. We do have it, however, in connection with the step from the conceptual order to the introceptual order. There is, in this relationship, the need also to step out of the conceptual order if you are to have actual realization of the introceptual order. Here is where the student may be caught for a long, long time. He may listen to a philosophy that is intended to orient the mind toward the introceptual order. It stirs in him a process of conceptual thought. And that can go on indefinitely. He finds ideas becoming clarified. He may spend years elaborating his thought, and he has not stepped out of the conceptual order. He has not attained realization of the introceptual order. Now, a certain amount of this elaboration of thought can be helpful, but it also can become an end in itself which leads nowhere. One finds himself sealed in, as it were, to the field or zone of conceptual thought. He may even circulate in there and get nowhere. But the thinking can be valid in the sense that it leads to a key conception for that individual, which can be the leaping off point into the introceptual order. On my own experience, the breaking of that vicious circle of conceptual illumination, which had lasted for many years, consisted in what you might call a deliberate non-completion of a proposition. I've been laboring for some years with the identification of the self I am this. And I projected it as an object, a conceptual object before me. And I realized that that conceptual object, which I called the self, was actually not the self, because I here was cognizing that there. So I took this I here again, put it out before me. And again I realized in time that I was cognizing an object out there which I called the self, but I hadn't got at the real cognizer. It was rather in the nature of an infinite series of regression that led nowhere, did not lead out of the field of concept. I finally realized that the realization of the self is represented not by the statement, I am this or I am that, but I am. Refuse to complete the proposition or judgment, but just sink back into the I. Radically stopping the conceptual process that would have finished the sentence. And the door opened. I found a way of leaping across the barrier between the conceptual order and the what I later found to be the interceptual order. This is a critical point. You're crossing a point of discontinuity or a point of hiatus which exists at the border between the conceptual and the introceptual. There is a point where thought must stop if one is to realize. Thought may be an aid, but there is a time when if it does not stop, one is locked into a conceptual circling that does not break through the walls. There's a point where it must stop in order that there may be a breakthrough. The critical problem in yoga, this is Jnana Yoga, is to determine how that breakthrough can be made. And it seems that it, the favorable condition for one individual may be different than that for another individual. But there must come the time where he breaks away from his thought series. It need not mean necessarily the literal stopping of thought. It could mean, however, the disregarding of the thought, a sort of division in the mind where the continuing autonomous, more or less autonomous thought process is set to one side while the central focus of the attention is turned toward that higher zone, which is the domain of the authentic, transcendental, or spiritual consciousness. There have been those who have insisted upon the careful definition of our conceptions. I'm sympathetic with this point of view, but it can be carried too far. One can achieve a false and deceptive precision. Rigorous definition produces, if carried through completely, 100%, leads to a condition that is completely locked into the conceptual order. A completely defined term or concept does not supply the base for leaping into the beyond. Complete definition means you understand certain conceptions in the light of other conceptions and not in the light of something beyond the conceptual order. Thus, for our purpose, we have to use terms that are only partly defined, only defined by indicators rather than by comprehensive statements. We might distinguish thus between two orders of concepts. The completely determined concepts, such as those used in mathematics, and the dangling or pointer concepts, which are not completely defined, that attain their fulfillment in the higher order, not within the conceptual field. My most important dangling or pointer concept is the concept of consciousness. This is a concept that cannot be defined. It can be indicated. Oh yes, a dictionary will substitute the word awareness or the word perception for it. But then you ask, what is awareness and what is perception? So you get driven back and you haven't found out what consciousness is. To really get an indicator of what consciousness is, you have to refer to experience. Now, I'm speaking in terms of ordinary consciousness at this moment. What we are when we wake up, as contrasted to what we were before we awoke when sleeping, or when under the influence of an anesthetic drug, that difference is consciousness versus unconsciousness. Well, this is indicating consciousness by reference to an experience, not by simple conceptual definition. What we are more and more, as we come out of the anesthetic sleep, that is consciousness. I think this is enough to indicate to anyone what I'm talking about when I speak of consciousness. But this is only ordinary consciousness. This is the consciousness that flows from myself, any I, towards some content, the world about. I'm aware of the various objects about which I call the world. The awareness is the content. The content of that consciousness is that world. Incidentally, that world that I've contacted is only a psychical image. Whether it has corresponding to it something that is non-conscious and non-psychical, we cannot know. For the act of knowing is drawing it in to the psychical field. And a non-conscious existence out of that psychical field is an eternally unknowable. Because of that, in my philosophy, I dispense with the conception of a non-conscious thing corresponding to the psychical image. Because there is no way of knowing it. There is no way of defining it. Since knowing involves consciousness, since defining involves consciousness, the non-conscious somewhat is, we cannot say even that it's non-existent or that it is existent. All we can say is that the notion of it is meaningless, and therefore we dispense with it. But in the development of the realizations that led finally to the I in the it became necessary to alter the meaning of consciousness. At the highest level, consciousness came to mean a self-existent consciousness which persisted by itself and was not the function of an entity that was conscious. But rather, that the entity was a projection or emanation out of that pure consciousness. Now, the conception of consciousness has become greatly changed from that with which we started. We started with it as in the sense of our ordinary consciousness, that which we have when we wake up from sleep or from the anesthetic drug, and which appears to us as a function of a conscious being, aware of a world of objects. And we arrive at the conception of consciousness, now using the same word, as self-existent and as the source of all worlds and of all source of all selves. Consciousness in this latter sense becomes the supreme principle. A principle higher than any God whatsoever. The conception of the gods do not become therefore meaningless. But the conception of God or God must be viewed as derivative. The God speaks, and God may be realized as experience, mystic experience. But it is not the highest mystic experience. On a higher level, all doubts and all selves are seen as derivative. And as I've said before, this is the key to the understanding of the teachings of the great Buddha and of the other Buddhas who followed him. Now, point here is that the word consciousness, if it were defined conceptual in the complete sense, would no longer serve us for our present purpose. We get a sort of partial grasp of what we're talking about by my reference to the difference between sleeping and waking up. But don't define it beyond that. Word defining doesn't help. On the stream of consciousness, one attains. We have to introduce the notion that there are different kinds of consciousness, maybe many kinds, and that the relationship of one kind of consciousness that we might call A to another kind of consciousness, which we might call B, would be such that to A, B would seem unconsciousness. And also vice versa, that to B, consciousness, A consciousness, would seem to be unconsciousness. Thus, the blanket term of the collective unconscious of Dr. Carl G. Jung is valid up to a point as expressing a relationship of another order of psyche with respect to our ordinary order, which is the relationship between a knower and a known. But it'd be incorrect to say that this unconscious in itself is a non-conscious state. It'd be truer to say that it is another kind of consciousness and can be realized in partial or even in complete degree as consciousness by the appropriate yogic steps. Consciousness is my great term, the central one in all the philosophy, but a term which cannot be defined. And if anybody defined it, it would cease to be a useful term. It would be a term actually contained by the real consciousness that defined it, and not the truth itself. This is my fundamental message.